Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. If you follow me for some time, you know I write a lot about the South, and my book, Southern Scribblings, is a collection of many of those essays. It's a great book. You're really going to want it. It tells you why I think the Southern tradition should be preserved and why it should be respected. Get Southern Scribblings at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, wherever books are sold online. You're really going to love it. A new poll has a number of Americans seriously considering secession. We'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act local. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. Well, let's talk about secession. We've been doing that a lot recently. But some new data is out on what Americans really think about it. There's a poll by YouGov. I'm going to read an article at the Abbeville Institute on the topic. Just came out a couple of days ago. But this is really interesting because for so long, the Lincolnian myth of America has dominated American education, the American establishment, American entertainment industry. We're seeing it now. We've got a new Apple TV program, Manhunt, which I haven't watched, but I'm sure is going to be pretty critical of the South. This is what the establishment does. We have to have the Lincolnian myth. We have to have this Lincolnian glue, so to speak, to hold the United States together. We take the Pledge of Allegiance every day when we go to school, right? One nation, indivisible. That came, of course, from a socialist minister, Francis Bellamy, for that reason. I mean, the idea was to ensure that no one would ever think about leaving the Union again. But it seems in 2024 that more Americans are thinking about what was now called a national divorce. What we know from the historical record is that Americans have been thinking about this for a long time. In fact, going all the way back to 1787. Now, the first documented case that someone was openly talking about secession once the Constitution was ratified was 1794, and that was two Northerners, Rufus King and Oliver Ellsworth, both of whom, by the way, were in the Philadelphia Convention, and they knew full well that secession was on the table there. John Taylor of Caroline was a senator from Virginia. They cornered him in the cloakroom of the Senate and said, "Look, why don't we just part ways right now?" And Taylor was shocked. What are we talking about? We've just had this constitution, this new government for about 5 years, and you're already talking about leaving? But we know in 1787, in the Philadelphia Convention, which of course was a secret proceeding, but people kept notes, not just James Madison. He kept the most detailed notes, but there are others. And we know that Governor Morris, for example, had talked about secession, in fact, a couple of times. One is really interesting. As Northerners and Southerners, and I talked about representation yesterday, as they were at butting heads over the future of the central authority, Governor Morris stepped up and said, "Well, look, if this is true, if we have these incompatible things, if the Northern states and the Eastern states," he called them, "are so incompatible, let's just separate now. Why are we going to try to force these things together that just aren't going to work? Why are we going to try to make this a situation where we're going to eventually have to have a divorce anyways? Why put the union together? And so Morris was from the mid-Atlantic states, right, representing Pennsylvania, New York, and, of course, from Pennsylvania at this point. But he certainly saw, he was actually from New York, but representing Pennsylvania, he certainly saw that there were things there that may not work. You had Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina kind of forming an alliance. And then you had the New England states doing the exact same thing, the Eastern states they were called. And there was certainly a break. This is the amazing thing about all of it. We were talking about secession in 1787, and in fact, that threat of secession was what drove many people to support the Constitution, because they thought it could hold the Union together better. Not that it was illegal, not that it's something that couldn't happen, but it would hold the Union together better, right? I mean, this is what George Washington said. Look, disunion's in the air, so we need to have this Constitution, so maybe we can have a better union, a more perfect union, as the document says, and maybe people won't want to leave. When Randolph goes before the Virginia Ratifying Convention, and he says, look, I'm for the Constitution because I'm against disunion. Virginia would be swallowed up if it's on its own. In other words, disunion was entirely possible. Everyone thought you could secede. We know this because 1794, you've got two New Englanders talking about it. You had New Englanders talking about it in 1800, 1801, 1803, 1805, 1815. These are all members of the founding generation. Secession was always legal and always possible. It's the reserve power of the states. They can leave. And this piece at the Abbeville Institute actually gets into some of that. So secession now is on the table, and it's always, well, that's treason. You can't leave the Union. Why? Why? Why can't you? I mean, are you that interested in coercion? Are you that against self-determination? People can't leave? Now, we know that there have been nefarious forces at times in the 20th century interested in decentralization. The communists wanted to destabilize the United States, so they would be interested in the movement. But, of course, we also know the communists were pretty good at it because, well, you had the Soviet states, the Baltic states interested in it. And, of course, you had several former Soviet republics leave in 1990. So they were good at it. They were good at getting away from Russia. But regardless, this is important. This is important. This topic is important. So, and again, why are Americans looking at this? Well, because we know that centralization creates tremendous political pressures. So the title of this piece, again, at the Abbeville Institute, is What If Secession Happens Now? It's by Kevin Orland Johnson, who's written a really interesting book on Abraham Lincoln, by the way. The Lincolns in the White House, where he talks about Lincoln's, the document that conclusively shows that Lincoln and his attorneys for his wife's estate actually sold slaves out of the estate. They could have freed them. As he explains in the book, I'll save that for you. You should get the book. But they could have freed them. They didn't. They profited from it. So Johnson says, recently a private polling company called YouGov conducted a survey asking Americans if they advocated the secession of their home state from the United States. North and South, Democrat and Republican, the distribution was fairly consistent, averaging to about 23% in favor of their state secession. 23%. Now, if you had asked this question 20 years ago, you wouldn't have gotten that. If you'd asked this question 30 or 40 years ago, it would have been far lower than this. Far lower than what you would have gotten 20 years ago. But now, a quarter of Americans are thinking, yeah. And in some cases, a majority in some states, in terms of party affiliation, are looking at that from looking around or what you could have. The survey, as reported on March 6 in the London Daily Mail, didn't inquire about respondents' reasons one way or the other. Those aren't very clear for disastrous states like New York at 28% and California at 29%. as both of them depend for their survival upon federal subsidies and protections. We can surmise the reason for residents of states that have to pay for that security, which had rates substantially higher. So these states, you've got a pretty prominent Cal exit movement by the left. I mean, these are leftists. They want out. Now, their response to Kevin Orrin Johnson saying, well, we're not getting, the South is getting all these subsidies. We're net payers, they're net receivers of federal subsidies. And this is a debate and a conversation that's often had. Well, yeah, we'd love to see the red states go. They just get all the money that we pay in. He says, one surprise was Alaska's highest rating, with 36% of the population favoring secession. I'm not really surprising about that. I'm not surprised about that at all. Alaska has a pretty prominent secession group, too. In fact, Sarah Palin's husband, ex-husband, was part of that group. While even before she was running for vice president, he was before that group, part of that group. So Alaska having a serious secession movement, I mean, why not? They're oil rich. They've got a great fishing industry. They could really make it on their own. Now, you could say, well, they need the defense of the United States. It would be swallowed up by Russia pretty quickly. Maybe if Russia turned aggressive, that could happen. But, I mean, regardless, they have some natural resources and other things that other places don't have. And so why not? I mean, but they're, again, that security issue right off the coast of Russia would be a problem. I mean, this is why the United States acquired it anyways, because they wanted to keep Russia out of North America. But it's an interesting situation with Alaska there. And they have their own culture, their own, I mean, Alaska is different. You can also see it with Hawaii. Why wouldn't Hawaii want to be independent? They had their own kingdom. Again, security. You could say, well, that being part of the United States provides security for them. But regardless, I mean, the culture is there to be independent. Less surprising was the second highest, Texas at 31%. Of course, a big Texas movement. Connecticut, the ancient party homeland since the Puritans took over in the 1630s, predictably had the lowest percentage in favor of leaving the Union, only 9%, and New England generally came in with figures lower than the average. New England was the home of secession originally. This is the amazing thing. But what changed with New England? Well, they figured out that the Union was pretty good if they could control it. That's that Eastern state and Southern state thing. This is what they were talking about. In fact, Madison points this out in a speech. He says, look, I mean, for a while, New England's going to control this thing. But when the Southern states and the Western states begin to fill up, and it was all about the West in 1787, it's about power. This is why there was such an incompatible thing going on there. When they begin to fill up and they start taking over, New England's going to be a minority. And New England knew it, which is why they didn't want the Three-Fifths Compromise. They didn't want to count slaves at all, though one Connecticuter, Johnson of Connecticut, said, well, wait a second here. Maybe we should count blacks equally with whites. I mean, this is something we should do because wealth should be a measure of representation. So maybe we should do that. In fact, the reason that we get the Three-Fifths Compromise solidified is because Connecticut cut a deal essentially with South Carolina. That was it. Okay, we're going to go with this. Three-Fifths, we're going to keep it. Southerners wanted to count them as one because they could see the problem with New England. They could see the issue there already in 1787. Reading the results of these polls closely, you can see that the peaceful secession of Great Britain from the European Union has made quite an impression on Americans. After all, when Britain voted to leave the EU, Brussels sent no battleships up the Thames to bombard London into submission. Brexit has later set the pattern for Texas. The proposition that Texas would be better off leaving the Union. The respondents pretty clearly don't understand anything much about the Constitution. The proposition that a state can legally secede was posed as moot and answered as a matter of opinion. But it's ironic that the purposeful degradation of our schools has left a whole generation so unfamiliar with the party's own history of the war that they've never heard the standard assertion that secession is forbidden by law. So 27% of the people polled weren't sure whether they favored secession or not, which, with the 23% in favor, adds up to fully half of Americans who see nothing inherently wrong with the basic idea, and presumably nothing illegal about it either. Right. It's not illegal. I mean, they haven't gotten the Lincolnian myth. They haven't gotten the message. Right? So this is the failure of public education. This is tongue-in-cheek for Johnson. He's saying this is a problem. In fact, there's never been anything in our laws to prevent a state secession from the Union. True. The simple fact is that each of the states joined the United States of America by ratifying the Constitution by convention or plebiscite, and that same authority empowers a state to leave. Even after the military surrendered Appomattox, the states never abdicated their sovereignty. States can't do that, in fact. They can surrender to a conqueror, but they can't pass a law repealing their own fundamental law. That law is what constitutes them as states, giving them the authority to pass laws in the first place. They can't pass a law saying that they have no authority to pass laws. This is all true, right? Sovereignty is important. Understand what that actually means. I've got a new class coming out in April about American conservatism. It's going to get to this point from one very important American conservative scholar from the founding period on sovereignty. You're going to want to take that class. You want these classes at McClanahan Academy because when you read these pieces, you're going to, oh yeah, I know this. I know this. When you get to populism and progressivism and here we get conservatism, you're going to know all this stuff. You're going to be better armed to go out and deal with the modern political trends of the day. Not just listen to this show, but you're going to have better primary documentation to back it up. Still less do states that come together to constitute a federation for themselves surrender their sovereignty to the federation. The federation itself is not sovereign. I mean, all of this is heresy on the Lincoln myth. All of this is heretical to what we've been taught after the war. All of this, and by the way, is an attack on James Madison. Because Madison would say, yeah, you can, there's sovereignty there, but that's a dubious claim. A federation that's created by the constituents can't be sovereign. It can have powers. But those powers can be rescinded at any time. That means they're not necessarily sovereign. If the central authority can be disbanded without its permission, which the Constitution allows, well, then it's not really sovereign. A state, though, cannot be disbanded without its permission. No matter what the Republicans in the 1860s said in the Supreme Court, what's interesting is in Texas v. White, Chase did say we have indestructible states. Well, that's curious because the Congress said that the states no longer exist until you ratify these amendments, which of course is illegal in itself. So you've got all these really weird things happening in the 1860s. The states created it by the power of their own sovereignty, so a transfer of sovereignty, apart from its impossibility, would be self-contradictory. The powers that created the Federation would no longer exist, and so the Federation, deriving its existence from those creative authorities, wouldn't exist either. So as Jefferson Davis phrased it in his Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government, you cannot claim, quote, that the creature is endowed with an authority not possessed by the Creator, or that a stream has risen to an elevation above that of its source. Well, when you start quoting Jefferson Davis, you've already created problems, right? In modern age, you can't quote, because everything bad is Jefferson Davis, which of course is just a silly assertion. But the Republicans are Jefferson Davis, the Democrats are Jefferson Davis, everybody's Jefferson Davis or John C. Calhoun. And those are the two boogeymen now in American politics. If you do say anything positive about either, oh, there you go. You just want to bring back slavery. Of course, that's not what he's doing here. Southerners were better versed in the original Constitution than anyone in the United States in the 1860s. The South hung on to originalism longer than anybody else. New England abandoned it when they figured out, well, we can have the central authority do what we want. We don't need that stuff anymore. You can get an accurate perspective on the relative position of states and their federations from collections of the primary sources, such as Philip B. Kurland and Ralph Lerner's The Founders' Constitution, and good explanations of the understanding in Lincoln's time from Davis and from Alexander Stephens' constitutional view of the war between the states. You can. Of course, there's better stuff. You can get the Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution, which has all of the primary documents in that. You can get Max Ferrand's 5-volume collection of documents relating to the Philadelphia Convention. You can get Eliot's debates. All of these things show conclusively that the Constitution was a compact between the states. The Nationalists lost. It's important to understand that. If you just read the ratification debates, you read the founding documents, you won't walk away with any other conclusion. The South was right in their position on secession. 100%. But a lot of Americans do seem to be confused on this point by the very structure of this federation. The Constitution was carefully crafted by 13 distinctively separate states to make the Union look like a single entity when seen from the outside. That's why they deputed to the Federation's offices their right to handle foreign affairs, to receive ambassadors from states that hadn't joined the Union. Each foreign state was to deal with the Federation as a single entity, rather than having to send an ambassador to each state. It's also why the states deputed to the Federation's government their power to have a navy, which by its very nature operates outside the common boundary of the Federation, right? So this is true. The Union was there for common defense and to keep commerce flowing free between the states. But to have one voice for foreign policy was important because you could see how chaotic it could be otherwise. And that was a problem. So they tried to solve that by creating a central authority that could do that thing. And of course, keep commerce flowing free, internationally and domestically. Here inside that boundary, forgotten that this is still a federation of free and independent states that was created by their own authority, and they created a limited union and joined it voluntarily, just like the EU. We also forget that these acts were not unanimous. To start with, there were 14 British colonies here. Canada decided not to declare independence with the others. And indeed, records of the Convention of 1776 show that each of the others decided on the declaration individually, some of them reluctantly. Georgia didn't send any delegates at all to the First Continental Congress and was perfectly free to go it alone. We forget that the Constitution was ratified by the states by their authority as states, and that Article 7 stipulates that the ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states, so ratifying the same. Between the states, right? And even Morris points this out. Well, hey, we get these states and the other states are kind of free. They said this in Philadelphia. The other states can just kind of do what they want. He points it out. Everyone knew this. Morris, by the way, eventually became a secessionist. Why? Because they knew that it was all legal. The other four, whichever they might be, were also perfectly free to go on without joining. Rhode Island famously held out until the last possible moment on the idea of becoming something like a modern Singapore or Hong Kong, a sort of Morocco of the New World. That plan was dropped when the other states threatened to refuse to trade with Rhode Island at all, or worse. Now, there was some coercion going on there. Well, if 9 hadn't agreed to the whole proposed Constitution, we would have been dropped anyways. We also forget that each of these states still joined the Union with a clear understanding that they could secede at will. The Declaration invokes the common courtesy of a decent respect to the opinions of mankind whenever one people dissolves a political band which connected them with another. And the seceding southern states did publish declarations of causes. But no reason for secession is necessary other than the same sovereign will by the state which the state joined. A state can just decide that she doesn't want to be bothered anymore. True. You don't have to tell people why, but you can. Some of the states, out of an abundance of caution, made that explicit. Rhode Island, predictably, ratified on May 29, 1790, but only with the stipulation, quote, that all power is naturally vested in and consequently derived from the people, and that the powers of government may be resumed by the people whensoever it shall become necessary to their happiness. Right. Yeah, these are called the resumption clauses. This is going to get into Rhode Island, New York, and Virginia. They all had them. These three states had them. New York already had explicitly reiterated the same principle of declaration and stipulated in its act of ratification of July 26, 1788, quote, the powers of government may be resumed by the people whensoever it shall become necessary to their happiness. And Virginia did that too, June 26, 1788, quote, we the delegates of the people of Virginia duly elected and now met in convention do in the name and behalf of the people of Virginia declare and make known that the powers granted under the Constitution being derived from the people of the United States may be resumed by them whensoever the same shall be perverted to their injury or oppression. They shouldn't have had to fight their way out of it. Each state had peacefully left, and the old Federation, constituted by the Articles of Confederation, simply by not sending delegates to the Continental Congress anymore, just as the Southern states were to secede in 1861 by recalling their congressional delegations. That's all true. This is why you should follow the Abbeville Institute. We publish stuff like this there. This is all true. If you understand the history of the United States, and you understand the history of American constitutionalism, secession would not be a shocking thing, nor would nullification, nor would any move for decentralization. So he asks, where does this leave us? Well, one doesn't want to sound a least bit inflammatory, like some later day Thomas Paine, still less a Patrick Henry revived. The obvious solution is to read the Constitution and renovate the federal government to set it in correspondence with the powers deputed to it by the states and with its limitations. That too can be done peacefully by processes already written into our fundamental law. Right, I mean, yeah. The reason people are thinking about leaving is because they don't think the central authority can do any of this. That the center cannot be reformed. And look, I share those sentiments. You got to do it from the bottom up, but you can do it within the union. I mean, the union does have benefit if it's doing what it's supposed to do. The founders and framers organized our system recognizing that the sovereign power of each state resides in its people, assembled in conventions, so we never need to overthrow any of our governments by force. Since 1860, the party has stigmatized secession as rebellion. But remember, there was no armed revolution on the part of the southern states. They simply seceded from the union by the same authority and through the same juristic process by which they had joined. And in 1861, as in 1776, they defended that uniquely American system against the invading armed forces of powers aimed at destroying their popular sovereignty. The history of the military campaigns is perfectly consistent with the history of the juristic principles, right? So, yes, this is true. When they left, they didn't attack the United States. Not in December, not in January, not in February, not in March. It was only when Lincoln showed aggression that they decided aggression had to be met in kind. James Buchanan showed no aggression, and we didn't have any war. Because secession is not an aggressive act, not in the American sense, when you can just do this peacefully. Of course, the threat of military force against the civilian population is always terrifying. But just as frightening is the fact that a regime imposed by such force always defeats its own purpose and crumbles into chaos. That threat of anarchy is probably why it's so hard to admit that as things now stand, the federal government doesn't do anything that it was constituted to do. That everything it does is extra-constitutional, which is to say unconstitutional, even possibly or positively preventing its constitutional functions, and that it doesn't do anything well or economically, not even sustainably. Yeah. This is true, right? I mean, this is why people are, again, wanting out. Doesn't matter if you're on the left or the right. You got leftists that say this. You got people on the right that say this. Of course, those on the left want the government to do more unconstitutional things generally, and they're not getting their way, so they want out. Those on the right are saying you're violating the Constitution over and over again, so we want out because you've broken the compact. It's a little difference. But in light of these surveys, that really makes it easy to see why secession is so attractive to so many. If Texas, for example, were to secede, she'd instantly stand as a world power and one of the richest. The state is already attracting profitable businesses and productive people from all across the rest of the Union, an exodus that could only be expected to increase to a state freed from federal regulation and taxation. We may well remember that, unlike the federal government with its few deputed powers and explicit limitations, each state is jurisdictionally complete in its structure of its sovereignty. That brings us to the central oblivion in all of this. We've forgotten what Alexander Hamilton himself said about the federal government, as James Madison transcribed his remarks at the Constitutional Convention. This is important. This quote is amazing. This is from Hamilton's notes. Hamilton had his own notes, and of course, even Hamilton kept some notes of the convention, but Madison wrote this down. Necessity. This does not apply to federal government. The federal government, in other words, is not necessary. This may dissolve the federal government, and yet the order of the community continue. Anarchy, not a necessary consequence. The federal government may dissolve, but the order of the community continue because the states still existed. See, that's the important thing to get about all of this. Secession is on the table. People don't really understand why. They can support it, but it's ingrained in the American character. It's there. It's the very Jeffersonian part of our character. But even people like Hamilton recognize that states could continue, though he said that they should maybe be reduced to their corporate parts, corporate entity, right? And maybe we should cut them down to size, so to speak. But interestingly enough, he was advocating for for state powers and the necessity of state powers. Even in New York, the New York Ratifying Convention, he said this. So, anyways, good stuff from Kevin Orlin Johnson at the Abbeville Institute. Secession's on the table. And this very American thing should be discussed. I mean, whether we should do it or not is another question, but the fact that it's there and we should be discussing these things is very important. All right. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.